more WGTD news. I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In this portion of WGTD's morning show, we are going to be talking about a harrowing film that is going to be shown tonight on the PBS series POV. The film is titled Nowhere to Hide, and it takes us into the heart of the nation of Iraq, and in particular, in the nation of Iraq in the wake of our withdrawal from Iraq. And we see firsthand the confusion and mayhem that has engulfed that country really ever since. And we do so through the lens of a camera held by an Iraqi by the name of Nori Sharif, a male nurse who also becomes a videographer at the invitation of my morning show guest, Zardasht Ahmed, who himself was born in Iraq, but for many years now has made his home in Norway and is an award-winning filmmaker. And he is ultimately responsible, along with Nori Sharif, for this remarkable film called Nowhere to Hide, in which we see the encroachment of violence and chaos into the life of this lovely young man and his family as they are eventually forced to flee from their home in search of safety somewhere within the borders of that beleaguered country. I'm very honored to be able to speak with the filmmaker who has done all kinds of important work that has taken him actually all around the world. Zardasht Ahmed, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be with you today. I'm looking forward.
Thank you. Tell us, first of all, a little bit about your own life in Iraq. You were born, your biography says, in northern Iraq, and a little bit about the circumstances under which you eventually left Iraq.
Yeah, I'm from northern part of the country. Northern part is it's a Kurdish part. We call it Kurdistan, Iraq. From the town of Suleymaniyah, where we visit also in the film. I left Iraq during the first Gulf War in 1991. And ever since I never went back for first 14 years. Then I first time after the invasion in 2003, then I could go back after 14 years in 2004. So that's been like my journey as a refugee also.
Mm. At what point did you yourself become interested in making films? And did that occur? That is, did you have that interest even while you were still living in Iraq?
I am more artist. I studied visual art before, and I continue studied that when I arrived in Norway. That was the first thing I tried to find, an art school, an art academy. So I spent some years studying visual arts and video art, and I started with some making music videos and all kinds. But then in one point, I felt like I could not express, I needed to express more. And documentary was more closest medium to me to fill that need. And I applied the university where they had the section of filmmaking and TV production. So I got in and finished my 3 years. So ever since I've been working on documentary, but mostly it was in 2001 I started to think to study more documentaries.
Before we begin talking about your film, Nowhere to Hide, one more question that I hope is not too personal. I would really be interested to know how it is that you found your way from Iraq to Norway. I think, at least at a glance, I can hardly think of two nations on the face of the earth more different from one another than Iraq and Norway. And I'm curious how it is Norway that is now your home, and also what life is like for you there, and to what extent you feel at home, in a place so different from where you were born and raised.
I have a really a long story of exactly this the years during the first Gulf War. Because when I left the Desert Storm in 91 was still going on, and I had no choice but either go to the army, go to the war, to the front line, or to leave. So I choose to leave. Then ever since I've been as a refugee. I spent 5 years between Iran and then Syria and then finally in Lebanon. So I got from Lebanon, I got asylum, like political asylum in Norway. Norway was very coincidence that I got there. It was just through Geneva Convention refugee law they have, and then they send you to those countries that they accept you, and Norway was one of them. And since 95 I've been living in Norway, but back in 90s up to 2001, when the 9/11 started, I think my life was really good in sense of like the difference and sense of you are young, you are trusted, you got the chance, and I was enjoying that chance. But after 9/11, things a lot of things changed. And the attitude toward us coming from Muslim countries, the attitude toward us Middle Eastern, and also by conflicts was rising in that area in Middle East. There were a rising of refugees, and more people came to Europe seeking shelter. More people left countries in Africa to get more better life. That's all affected us in Europe, and the identity question was often popping up to face those kind of existential questions. So for me, life has been up, down, but you when you understand things around you, when you understand the circumstances, when you understand why you are here and what's mean to be a human in a different culture with a different background, culturally background, and need to be integrated in this new culture. So once I started to understand that, once I started to study, once I started to build my own life very independently, then I could see the very positive sides of being in exile. And then you accept this new reality. You accept the people. You accept the changes. You accept these challenges. So you are prepared for it. So my life is quite good for me. Norway has been always the shelter, that shelter that saved me, gave me a second chance. So that's always remained. That's always there. But of course, people are changing all the time. People are, especially nowadays, with rising conflicts all over the world, and the question of immigration, the question of terrorism, the question of identity, globalization, all these affect us.
And even in Norway, these questions emerge.
Why not? Why not? Norway also part of this the community, and also people are. You know, the thing is, like, people are the same everywhere. People are listening to the same sources of media. People are watching almost the same films that produce in Hollywood and elsewhere. People have now they have social media that it's into your house anytime. You have access to information in a matter of second to without any consideration of distance. That's affect us. That makes us also be aware of things that it's not exist in our life. So Norway, as all the other countries, as also in America, and also in other countries that I've been in Africa, in North Africa, in Southeast Asia, where I work now, it's the same. And when you think about it, much of it because of the social media, because of that access, because of that everybody have a mobile phone, everybody have internet, everybody have camera, everybody listen, send, receive information every day. So that's in a way make almost similarity of thinking,
right?
Without any cultural hindrance in a way.
Sure. So many of these same difficult questions are being asked and pondered all over the world, including as idyllic a place as Norway. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Zahradasht Ahmed, who is an award-winning filmmaker whose latest film, or at least one of his most recent films, is airing tonight on PBS. The film is called Nowhere to Hide, and it chronicles, in a sense, the gradual disintegration of life in the nation of Iraq in the wake of America's military withdrawal from that country. Zahradasht Ahmed, I've already mentioned the fact that much of this documentary is comprised of film footage taken by a relatively young man named Nori Sharif. And I believe it is a case of you giving him a film camera and asking him to chronicle what he experiences in his daily life there in Iraq. How did the two of you first meet? And at what point did you have the idea of giving a film camera to this young man, Nori Sharif?
Yes. I was working on another film about the invasion in Iraq under the occupation force. And in 2010, I went back to research and to understand which kind of war was it. And then when I went there, I was also working with a Norwegian doctor. You have a couple of scenes with him in the film, Dr. Hans Husum. He's a war surgeon, and through him, I got access to all those areas that there were tensioned and there were military activities with the militants group and also American presence in middle Iraq, in the central Iraq. So I went there, but you know, at that time the embedded journalism was too much pretty new, and that was the only way you could get access to at least the part that was from the alliance and the American troops with the Iraqis. And the other alternative was to join some of those Al Qaeda groups and the militants, the militia, which both for me was very difficult to accept in a way, because I wanted to understand from the ground. I want to understand it from the point of view of the civilian. But it was almost impossible. And through the network that Dr. Husum was working on, I got to know about 10 medics, 10 to 12 they were in the beginning, and one of them was Nuri Sharif. I teach them 1 year, all of them, to bring footages, events from their hospitals. All they were medics from different towns, including Nuri's town, Jalawla. But in 2011, unexpectedly, we were not expecting that the troops will pull out, but Obama did the promise, and they left Iraq in the end of 2011. So we were, in a way, facing a new era in Iraq. Partly, we were very optimistic. And partly I was also pessimistic about the situation, because it didn't look like it's going to be fine. But the American presence was a big problem. So everybody was happy that finally the occupation power will disappear, and maybe we start to rebuild and do the better life without Saddam Hussein, the dictator. But unfortunately, the violence was escalating day by day. There were more suicide bombers coming into the country. More car bombs were, more advanced car bombs. There were explosions like 2, 3, 5 times in the same area. Very well planned, very well, in a way, strategically used, all these things. So there were kind of brain behind it. It was not a chaotic way. So I start to think about a different way of telling the story, because the American were not there anymore. But unfortunately, Nuri's town was the place where a lot of things were happening around it. And so during that period of ISIS coming and things, I decided to, then it will be about him, about giving him the whole space to bring that first information out through
what,
me.
What was it about Nuri Sharif that made you think he would be a good choice to do this? I mean, I suspect that it goes beyond the fact that he happened to be living in a town that was in close proximity to some of the heated action in Iraq, and you probably had a sense that he was going to be a witness to important events. But I suspect it also has something to do with who he was as a human being that made you think that he would be somebody well-equipped, maybe emotionally and mentally, to chronicle these events.
You know, I mentioned this. There were 10 to 12 medics. I worked with them during the whole 2010. And then they were four together with Nuri State, remain, but they are not in the film. One of them in the film, in a couple of scenes we see him, but others are not in the film, not visible. And that's because when you go for a big production of a documentary, based on a character, based on a person, based on a family. So there are many criteria that you have to have in advance. Then you go for that film. Then you go for that idea. Then you go. Then you spend all your energy to realize that. And for Nuri, of course, in the beginning, like all other people, that they use camera as part of the amateur way of just documenting without thinking the storytelling, and without also thinking about bringing the material in a best way technically and also context-wise. Everybody was, all of them, they were in these important towns. But one of them, only one of them, he was very keen of bringing material that was totally different. And that was Nuri. Hmm. He had access to the leftover from the 2003 to up to 2011 war, when the American was there. He had access to all that area, many towns around him, because he was helping them. He was giving them medicines. He was bandaging them many times, like some of them you see in the film. And that's make me feel that he's very dedicated, and it's something bothering him, because for him it was like these are stories nobody ask about them. Like the guy, the shipperman, he was just innocent man, was in the wrong place, wrong time, and were hit by a convoy, American convoy, and almost died. All his cousins and friends died in that ambush. But nobody was even asking who he was. No, he was just nobody. And there were plenty of them. People were being attacked by Al-Qaeda, people being attacked by other groups, people being attacked of internal conflicts, and nobody was asking about them. Doctors were killed, teachers were kidnapped and found without head, beheaded, and kids, small boys, were disappearing, and all these things were happening, and nobody was talking about it. Mm. Just like it not exist. So he was the access to that part, and upon all that, he was brave, and he wanted me to help him with that. Mm. And for me, that was enough motivation to jeopardize the film, jeopardize whatever it's coming, and go for something I didn't know how it was going to end. Mm. So. For me, that guts, that need of telling something, need of telling something true, not fallible, and ask you to help him, that was enough motivation.
Right. And we really get a sense, as he is capturing the image of various people experiencing various kinds of sorrows and suffering, that he feels deeply for them. So this is not somebody who is jaded, who views these things with no sense of compassion and merely just trying to capture interesting footage. But beyond that, he has a very sincere desire to tell these important stories. One of the things I appreciate about the film is that we not only see images of people who've been seriously injured or people who have lost loved ones and are weeping and so on, but there are also images of great happiness and joy, particularly early in the film. For instance, when we see images of Nori's lovely wife and his four darling children playing and laughing together, another sequence in the film in which we see people joyously dancing at a wedding. And it reminds us that even in a place like Iraq, even at a time in its history when so much is in tumult, that people still have this desire for joy and fun in their everyday lives and find it where they can. And I suspect that you as the filmmaker were anxious to make sure that those kind of images were also part of this film.
Yeah, sure, because it's like, you know, human are a very strange creature, you know, like we think when we talk about war, we think war is something always it's burning. It's not like that. Even during the war, there is life, you know, because that's what keep people continue living. There is war, there's going on, it's there. But life is not stopping. You know, people still are married, people still make babies, people still eat, go and provide food. They wait until to the end when it's impossible anymore, which is happening in the film. And then you have to leave because then it's not your life, it's your family's life. So you try to find at least a bit of hope somewhere else. That was driven people to continue live. Hmm. And to feel that they are human being,
right?
And they have a life. So of course, in a film like Nowhere to Hide, we needed to also show that side parallel with the other things that were happening. But the changes were so major, I could not just continue build a very positive picture on the reality there. I'm trying to, you know, manipulate people around me. That was the reality for me. Upon that, that was the really what was happening for Nuri.
Right.
And that's how we were thinking.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Zardasht Ahmed, who is responsible for a remarkable film airing tonight on PBS on the series POV. It's called Nowhere to Hide. And it chronicles the gradual disintegration of life in the central region of Iraq in the wake of America's military withdrawal from Iraq. The film actually begins on the last day of 2011. And by a year later, December of 2012, violence and corruption has begun to really dramatically escalate in the country. In fact, that's one of the most intriguing moments when Nori Sharif, again, the young male nurse who is capturing most of the images we see with a camera that's been given to him, talks about or is asked by somebody about who one can trust in a place and time like this. And he basically says, no one. You cannot trust anybody anymore. It might even be your neighbor, whom you thought of as a friend, who turns out to be somebody on the other side of this conflict, planting car bombs or whatever. And it's an interesting moment in the film because I think that is something typically not thought about by those of us on the outside looking in, that one of the most harmful and disconcerting things about this kind of situation, even beyond all the violence and mayhem that gets the headlines, is just this sense of loss of trust in those that you are living with. I mean, even the people in your own neighborhood, it is impossible to trust them in the way that you did before. And it's just hard to imagine what it's like to have to live with that.
Yeah. Do you want me to comment on that, about why it is like that?
Sure.
I think, you know, if you look at the history of war, like if you categorize them, you know, I can categorize it like three major generation in a way, in the first and then the second one and then the third one, which we go back to the very, 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 very primitive controlling fight to control area and then tackling down the regimes and put new one or conquer the whole land. And then to the second, where there were big major alliances fighting each other, such as the World War One and World War Two, and then the third one was the this new war in Balkan in elsewhere that they were running surgery, you know, like going in and making a surgery and then taking away something and then replacing it with something else. But now this, with this, you can call it fourth generation warfare. It's not about territorial anymore. It's not territorial war. And it's not the traditional armies going in, and it's, there's no countries put in charge. There's no countries follow to bring to hag and judge and blame and make them pay and make them, you know, what you call it, control and all these things. It's not this anymore. There is the armies is an identified army. You don't know where they are coming from, who this they're funding them, who belonging to. There are nobody you can blame, no country to blame to say, okay, this army is belonging to you. There are no face for those armies. There are no identity. There can be from anywhere in the world, like in the case of ISIS. So what they depend on, what they try to use as a very efficient tool, not bombing by plane, not bombing by big hydrogenic or atomic or these kind of shocking things, but they were going in to this psychological thing. Like it's you see it now in this, the terror. You know, if you look at it, there are very few people died, killed by terrorism. But yet the human brain functioned that way, that all the time is focused on it. All the time we are more afraid of that than afraid of being hit by a car or killed by a police or car accident or whatever, which is 10 times more or 20 times more in many cases. Than a terrorist attack. So they managed to go into that area. They managed to make you losing this belongingness, making you not belonging to where you are, trying all the time to change where you are. And once you are like that, then it's nothing to trust, nothing to your neighbor is the one probably. You are looking at the neighbor suspected. And when you start looking at him as somebody you don't trust, he will not trust you. She will not trust you. And something happened in the area, you blame all of them. And what the other thing was, like, everybody was targeting Iraq. Everybody was, you know, like, why you target a doctor? Why target an ambulance driver? Why you target a market where only old people and young people are going buying food? Poor people are going to buy their daily food, sell their daily food, and all this everyday thing, just to make people not trusting each other anymore, just to break down this feeling of I belong here. This is my country. This is my land. This is my house. So that was the most efficient weapon they used.
And it works well, of course, to sow that kind of fear. By the spring of 2013, of course, the situation becomes much, much worse. And at this point, As we are seeing footage of demonstrations and more violence and more sorrow, Nuri Sharif says something very, very interesting. And I think this speaks to what you were just saying, something to the effect that I don't understand this war. It changes every second. It is an undiagnosed war. You see the symptoms, but don't understand the disease. He's speaking about war in a way that is very uncommon, but he's obviously trying to describe the mayhem engulfing his country and how it is something that he has never seen or even imagined before.
Yeah, it's 2013, when things build on a wrong basis, on a wrong fundament, it will no, never hold. It will collapse. And that was in case of Iraq. In 2003, they brought some people who had nothing to do with how the reality was in Iraq, and they remove a dictatorship ruling over 30 years, and left a big gap. And there were a lot of chaos around the whole process of going from a liberator to an occupier, and then bringing people rule the country. But at the same time, all these conflicts woke up. All these, even conflicts that there were 1400 years old, all woke up, all came back to life. And then apart of that, all this regional and superpowers, they have interest in the area. Suddenly, there were a lot of old conflicts happen, and they were fighting a war on other people's territory, like it's happening now in Syria. So Iraq became some kind of a ground for all these old and new and worries of who's controlling the area. So everybody was putting their effort in it. Everybody from all the neighbors, without any exceptions, from you name it, from Saudi up to Turkey up to Syria. See, during that time, Syria was sending thousands of jihadis to Iraq. Thousands of jihadis. Later on, they start the medicine. They have to taste the same medicine themselves, and that's because they were part of a bigger war, but not a traditional war. So all these things combined with all the old conflicts, combined with this the market of war, the market of war, you name it, from the very advanced heavy war machinery and production, to the mercenary people, to those who left over from Chechen war, Chechnya, from Afghanistan, from all elsewhere. All they were finding that market in Iraq.
Right, that
So,
market of war and terror there, yes.
market of blood, you can call it. People, Iraqis were calling it the market of blood. And that's for normal, for a guy who used to work with humanitarian activity, every day going helping people. Suddenly, strange things come to on his table, and he have to deal with it. Of course, it's like it's an it's undiagnosable war. You cannot understand the disease, but you
Right.
see the problems.
There's actually a line very early in the film when he talks about he has been a nurse in Iraq for 13 years, and he talks about how once upon a time he treated ordinary injuries, sprained ankles and that sort of thing, but since the time of America's invasion of Iraq and all the years since, the seriousness of the injuries he has treated in that hospital have grown far more serious over the years. And then, of course, eventually the violence and mayhem comes right to that particular community. And almost in an instant, most of the staff flees the hospital. And Nori Sharif and five of his colleagues are the only ones left to try and run this hospital. Do you know why he decided to remain when so many others at that point in time chose to flee?
I remember very well that period. Of course, in the film, you cannot use all the period, but during that period, especially the night we see in the hospital, that is the time when ISIS already advancing. So, and everybody understood that they will not manage to hold, you know. Anywhere ISIS were going, everybody was escaping, you know, including the military, because they left the whole military, this multi-billion spending dollars on, you know, on this advanced new Iraqi army. There were nobody there. They left. They were, so those kind of satanic deals, you know, like people are calling it like that, you know, satanic deals. They don't know why. Suddenly there were nobody, absolutely nobody to defend anything. And then ISIS came, blow a couple of people, you know, suicide bombers. And then even the Peshmerga, those who are controlling those, you know, the brave ones, with the Shia in the other side of the town, everybody was flee, you know, because like, you know, that's the thing you don't want to die for. So I was in daily contact. I was in Iraq. I could not go to the town. I could not go there because it was like a military zone. But I had contact with him. He was very scared. I remember he many times he asked me, stay, you know, stay on phone, let you talk. And I, of course, I asked him, why you don't leave? Leave. Don't jeopardize. It's not worth it. But I don't know. Sometimes it's just like that. Sometimes you don't think rational. You are irrational. Of course, I have material from that period. And there are beautiful materials, but of course, for the story, we could not use. Otherwise, it would have affected the whole line
Of course.
of the things. But there were like these other five colleague of him. You know, they were staying. And then in the end, when the electricity and power supply went off, and they have the day after, there were a lot of injuries came in, and we have a couple of scenes from that. Then you cannot leave, you know. Then you cannot. At that the night he was a little bit unsure to maybe he would leave tomorrow. But when you see all these injured, it's like a this is like a human thing, you know. Like this is like your ethic, all the sense of ethic, all the sense of moral, all the sense of responsibility, make you not leave. I
Right.
think that was the.
Of course. Of
I
course.
think that was the that power that kept him, you know,
Yeah.
like staying.
Yeah. Eventually, of course, the violence becomes so bad that he decides that he and his family must flee. They themselves must become refugees. And nearly at a moment's notice, they pack up all that they can in their little car and flee. I think such a poignant moment as he captures some of that is when we hear one of the little children, this they're still in their home, asking, you know, Daddy, where is our TV? Can't we bring our TV? And the father explains that they have hidden the TV away, and no, we can't take the TV with us. And of course, the children have to leave behind nearly all of their toys, and away they go. And they don't even know exactly where they're going, and then have to flee again and again and again. I think at one point, it becomes apparent to us that Nori began this project, in a sense, telling the story of other people's suffering. And by the end of this film, he himself and his family are suddenly swallowed up by that story that, in a sense, he was seeing at something of a distance. He is becoming, in a sense, one of those sad stories about this period in Iraq.
Exactly. Because that, yeah.
Can you tell us, we want to leave it to our listeners to view the film, to see what happens to Nori and his family. Maybe you could just say a word, though, about what you think we learn from the film about the plight of refugees, of what it is like to be a refugee in a place like Iraq at this time.
Yeah, this is the smaller question. But the bigger question is what we learn as a human being, you know, because we use a lot the refugee crisis phrase. But in reality, to think about it honestly, you know, it's not a refugee crisis. It's a human humanity crisis. Because there should not be at all wars. There should not be at all refugees. But there is a problem in the humanism. There's a problem in how we look at the human itself, how much we respect that, and how much we care. That's the reason there is war. That's the reason there is refugees. There is poverty. There is illiterate community. There is child labor. There is trafficking. There's all these anti-human being activities. So refugee is part of it. I think throughout the film, because a good film is the film that first change you as a filmmaker. That's a golden rule of good films, good stories. When it affects you, it's make you, which it does with me, you know, like working with that topic with Nuri and witnessing all these things, I was never the same person after the process of making the film. You're never the same person. A lot of things are processing in your brain, and you change your way of thinking.
Right.
And knowing to hide my experience with it, it will make you reflect totally differently about these different distance catastrophes happen to other people. And nowhere to hide, it's not anymore other people. Nowhere to hide, it's about human, like me and you.
Exactly.
So that's what's happening in the film. That's what's it's about. You know, we learn. It's just like an electroshock giving you the again energy to your brain. Start to think about these very essential feelings to be human. You know, like care.
Right.
To care about
exactly to put a human face on the suffering people of Iraq and to realize that they are, in so many ways, exactly like us. They want the same things from life, and their sorrows and fears and hopes become ours as well as we watch this incredible film. Again, the film is called Nowhere to Hide. It airs tonight on the PBS series POV, and Zardasht Ahmed responsible for it. Zardasht Ahmed, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, and thank you for helping to create this marvelous film. Our best wishes to you and, of course, to Nuri Sharif and his family.
Thank you very much to also give me opportunity to add that extra to. So I appreciate your effort as well. And I hope we all learn something from about other things happening outside our doors, outside our borders, outside our world, you know. So that's my...
And again, that film airs tonight on Milwaukee PBS. Tomorrow on the morning show, Bonnie J. Ruff, the author of a book called Beyond Birds and Bees, bringing home a new message to our kids about sex, love, and equality. Bonnie Ruff lived for a time in the Netherlands, and it really was an experience that helped reshape her ideas about how we should talk about matters related to sex with our children. When should we talk to them, and in what terms? How specific to get? How graphic to get? And it's a really fascinating book, and you'll hear my conversation with Bonnie Ruff on tomorrow's morning show. Wednesday, Dr. Art Sear, a regular visitor to the morning show, pays his monthly visit to the program to offer his analysis of current events. On Thursday, we'll be talking about the Schools of Hope program in Racine, which places volunteer tutors in area schools. On Friday, Margaret Wilkerson Sexton, the author of a wonderful novel called A New Kind of Freedom, set in her hometown of New Orleans and spanning three different generations of Black American families living there and contending with various challenges. The Morning Show is archived on our website, wgtd.org. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees, transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information is available at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. This is WGTD HD.